Just a second. My child was banging on the piano. I apologize. I don't have internet issues, but I have other issues.
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Back with us this week is alumni of the podcast, or a version of it, Richard Wally.
Dun, dun, dun.
The old co-host. How's it going?
It is going very well. You're Cassidy Robinson, and you're in Las Vegas. You used to make me say that stuff. Do we still say that stuff? I don't know what we say.
I don't know either.
Am I supposed to talk about movies?
Yes, generally. Oh, okay. That's good. What we're doing there. Here.
Okay, but I wasn't sure. I just wanted to make sure.
I'm on a new sleep schedule. You know this. The listeners don't. So I've been working graveyards 2 days out of the 5 days that I work, and it's made me go a little loopy. So This could be interesting.
I have a toddler, so that makes me loopy. So we'll just be loopy together.
It's the Loopy Cast. Today we're going to be talking about Midsommar, which I've been really excited to talk about for a while. And we're going to also be talking about Spider-Man Far From Home. And we have some movie news to catch up with. We are going to hold the Netflix homework, which has changed since the last time we announced it because they took it off of the streaming service. So, once upon a time, the Netflix homework was going to be Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is no longer there. But when I return to the show with Keith, we will be talking about Night Moves.
Well, you could just also look it up. It might be on one of 1,000 other streaming devices. Or are you still exclusive to Netflix?
Well, you know.
That monogamous relationship with them?
We're thinking about opening it up.
You should get around. There's a lot of options out there.
Yeah. We're talking to other services right now, and, things might happen. So I do want to catch up with you a little bit. I know that you've been moving around. I think you're currently in Salt Lake City?
Currently in Salt Lake City, yes. Still in the middle of a, like, six-month process.
Yes.
Settling into jobs and life and all that kind of stuff. And we recently moved a good chunk of our belongings into the place we're currently at. So things are going, they're a little more steady than they have been. I mean, I don't really care, but it's good to be steady, I suppose.
Yeah. People like stability.
Yeah. You know, not eating garbage out of the streets. It's fine.
Yeah.
No, I don't do that. I'm fine, everyone. Fine, internet.
Salt Lake has a little bit of a film culture there. I mean, obviously you have Sundance right around the corner.
Well, there's the Broadway and the mm-hmm. Tower, and they have like little film things. And I mean, it's a good movie town. There's tons of commercial theaters too.
Yeah, I think there's actually more in Salt Lake than there is in Las Vegas. And people might think of Las Vegas as being more of like a thriving, bigger cultural hub or whatever, but there are no repertory theaters here. None. Zero. Zip. The closest thing you get to that, they do those like movies in the lawn for kids and they show like, you know, Toy Story or something.
We got those too. But
yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, this town's good. It's not necessarily as movie centric as like somewhere like Portland where I used to live, but it's still pretty good, and there is a thriving little subculture.
So, yeah, I'd say of all the things that I miss from Los Angeles, it is the repertory theaters. And, you know, being able to drive down on a Saturday night to go see something into Beverly or something like that.
Well, it was a big part of your life, too, and when something's gone, that's when you really start to miss it, you know. That's what has to go. So, Yeah, we kind of had that with here. It's actually, it's pretty comparable. It's like, there's a lot of good stuff about Salt Lake City, but our two big theaters, you know, is a big one for us. And theaters were a huge thing in Portland. There were so many little fun theaters and repertory. And then even some big, like IMAX-y, whatever kind of theaters that were really cool. Here they have all of that. It's just a little bit of a downgrade, not a lot, just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the food is the same thing though. That's another big thing for us, is we like to go out and get some good grub. And the food is good here, but just a little bit not as good. So it's just very weird.
There's just like certain things that were very regional or whatever.
It's like we downgraded like internet service or something. just a little bit though. Not enough to like really piss you off, but just like when you get on too many phones, you're like, oh, we have slower internet service. That's it.
Right. So. All right. Well, there's a segment we like to do here. It's kind of new. I don't know if you've been a part of this yet, but we have a segment called Consume Obey. In which we discuss the media that we are currently obsessed with. So what are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you watching? What is your current obsession?
Let's see. What am I obsessed with? Well, right now I'm reading House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski. I don't know if I said that right. It's about 12. It's, you know, one of them Eastern European names. Anyways, yeah. It's a huge book. I'm kind of floundering in it a little bit. It's very weird and experimental. I kind of dig it, but it's taken me a little bit. What are we watching? We haven't been watching as much lately. The only thing that we're kind of obsessed with is Jackie just watched Dune, or just didn't watch Dune. She just read Dune. And so we've been talking about that because the Denis Villeneuve film will be coming out. Mm-hmm. And I've been obsessing about that pretty hard.
That's cool. Have you gone back and watched the Lynch movie, or are you just going to go in kind of clean?
I'll probably do both. I like the Lynch movie. It's not great, but it's fun. And
it has a culty appeal.
Yeah, and I like a lot of it. Like, I played these weird computer games of the Dune series, and then I read the book several times, and it's just been a part of my life for so long. So then when a director I really liked is making this huge thing with a really awesome cast, it's just like, oh, shit. And so, yeah, I'll be obsessed about that, just, like, waiting.
Right.
Let's see, what else? We're just kind of waiting for some of the shows we're crazy about. Like Mindhunter will come back on soon. Mm-hmm. And I think Glow's coming back on soon. So,
oh, did you see, speaking of Mindhunter, I saw a thing on Twitter today. The same guy who's playing a young Charles Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is also playing an older Charles Manson in Mindhunter.
I didn't see that, but that
talk about typecasting.
He should just have to play the rest of his career. He should just have to be Charles Manson.
He's got that market cornered.
Like, just obligatory in every film. Like, nobody gets to choose. Right. It's that actor.
Like, John Hawks refuses to ever play him. So this guy is stepping in to be the hero.
Somebody's got to take that one. Somebody's got to be old Charlie.
Right. So. Okay, that's cool. That's more than what I usually ask for. But it makes sense. You're not on here every week. So I guess I asked this question without really having something prepared to say. I just went through my Spotify history to see what I'm listening to right now. And I've been listening a lot to the first Dead Guy album. Mm. They were like a metallic hardcore band in the early, on the mid-90s, more or less. Their first album, Fixation on a Coworker, is like pretty much perfect for that genre. Like, if you just like super pissed heavy hardcore with riffs, and I think indisputably one of the best vocalists of that genre, it's good.
Is what it's called?
Dead Guy is the name of the band, yeah. And they have a few records. I think they have like three or four. But the first one, Fixation on a Coworker, is what really gets me going.
I'll try that.
A lot of energy. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of vocalists out there who try to sound tough, and they, you know, they put their, they cup the mic and put it really close to their face and growl into it, and it's whatever. And there's plenty of bands I like that do that, but this guy sounds like, I think it was the guys on Axe to Grind who described it best. It sounds like he dropped a bowling pin on his toe and then started singing. Like, it sounds like it's coming from a genuine place.
Oh, good.
Good. But yeah, that's my current musical obsession. But let's go ahead and get into some of this movie news. We haven't had a show in a few weeks, so we're a little backed up. And there's
a little show constipation.
Yeah, we're gonna get it through though, and we're gonna start here. Netflix orders Neil Gaiman comic adaptation Sandman. So, how many times have we talked about the possibility of a Sandman television show or movie?
I mean, are we talking just on the podcast, or we're talking in life? Because that's a long curve.
Well, you
like,
know,
I mean, honestly, like even before we ever did a podcast together, which now we're not doing a podcast together. So that's how long, a long time, even as just friends, like even just right. like barely post high school.
Too long, a long time.
So, yeah. I don't know.
So I guess this version of, remember Once Upon a Time, it was supposed to be Joseph Gordon-Levitt who was going to play him. Yeah, I guess.
And write it and direct it or something.
Yeah, that never happened.
Well, to be honest, right now we're in a content war. And that's not necessarily bad for people who love, like, big mass media things. And this could be cool.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty good. I've decided that it might be good for, like, those middle ground kind of things that Netflix kind of off the Disney tit. Because they'll go to weirder content and different combat, even like Umbrella Academy and some of that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's a weird choice. So I think that it's a good thing. And just because there's Amazon and Hulu and Disney and everybody's, well, I guess Hulu and Disney are the same thing now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a many backed beast. But I think it's a good thing. I think Netflix, if they put money into it, and I don't even know if they have to put that much money into it. It's mostly just getting the weird atmosphere and just the strangeness right.
Sure.
And that comes down to showrunners, really. That doesn't come down to, I wouldn't even say budget per se.
Well, it says here, after years of talk, it says Alan Heinberg of Wonder Woman and Grey's Anatomy will write and serve as the showrunner. Gaiman is set to executive produce along with David S. Goyer.
Mixed bag. Grey's Anatomy says nothing to me. The showrunner
does to some people.
Maybe in a bad way. I know that has a weird cult following. I've never been interested in it. I've not seen it really either, so I can't really talk. But
right.
You know, Gaiman he showran American Gods at Stars. He's had a big hand in executive produced the Good Omens thing at Amazon Prime. So
yeah,
it depends on how heavy his control is over it, too.
And Gaiman is really like having a moment.
And I mean, he's kind of been always a bit like almost too big to be a cult writer, even though he was a cult writer technically for a while. And then he just, I think right now is time. I think it's because the mass paper book market crashed in the mid 90s, I think. I might be off on the time scale there, but when it crashed, I think, you know, a lot of authors had a lot of hard time getting traction. So it's good to see somebody. Somebody should get it. And I like his stuff. I think it's delightful. So I don't have a problem. Yeah.
I mean, Netflix is kind of a, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in Netflix. There's a lot of garbage on Netflix too. So it's just kind of a roll of the dice.
I agree. But I do think it's getting better. And I think that their original content has to get better for them to do that. And so I think that's why they're building up these little original IPs. One thing I will say about American Gods that's different about this Sandman show is the showrunner why can't I think of his name right now? But the showrunner on
The guy from American Hannibal, Gods, right?
Yes, the guy from Hannibal is amazing. Yeah. He's an auteur in the world of showrunning. And I'm not bullshitting. I'm not being pretentious. I'm being completely sincere.
All right.
He does some beautiful work, and he always brings in David Slade, who has a really good eye for things. Mm-hmm. Some people might not like all of his content, but he had a really strong beginning. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're probably going to have a little less to say about this one. Meet the new Little Mermaid, star Halle Bailey. So this is actually kind of old news because this already like happened on the internet. It had its moment of like being announced and then everyone being pissed about it. Then a backlash to the backlash. Now we're all the way on the other side of this tunnel, on the internet anyway. But so, Halle Bailey is African American.
At least she's for this cycle.
Yes. For this cycle. I believe she's a singer or has some Disney connections before this. This Little Mermaid is going to be directed by Rob Marshall. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it's more Disney live action baloney. I mean, yep. It has the potential to be cool looking because of CG and stuff like that, but it really just comes down to the content, which
yeah,
about 90% of these just have not had that. So, yeah, I don't know. Whatever. That's all I got to say.
Right. I thought it was so funny. So there's... I mean, I get this character means Ariel, means a lot more
to the redhead community.
To the redhead community and also the just girls of a certain age, you know, who grew up with that movie and watched it a million times and they see it as being something very specific. And then so when they cast this person, there was the redhead community did come out with their Tritons and we're upset about it. And then there was a lot of like, well, you're fucking racist. And it's like, blah, 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 blah. And I just saw this like all happening online. It's like, you guys, this is going to suck no matter what. Like, this is just going to be just garbage. It's just going to be a slow, weird, goofy community theater version of a cartoon we really like.
Which one's Rob Marshall? I can't even remember.
He did Chicago, I think, in Memories of a Geisha, and then one of the last Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Okay. Sorry, you're right. I have nothing to say. I think you hit it on the nail. Like, this is going to probably be hot garbage. So we can either argue about it and just destroy our nation because of the Black Mermaid, or we could all just decide
to unite,
kind of tripe,
and yeah. Just
go and fight about something else. There's plenty of stuff to tear our nation down over. Let's not make it the Little Mermaid.
I think that's all you really need to say about it. Yep. Okay. What's something else? Oh, this is sort of interesting. Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach are going to write the Margot Robbie starring Barbie movie. So this is another property that's gone through sort of an evolution because a long time ago, we had announced that the Barbie movie was going to be co-written and starring Amy Schumer back when she was still a hot property. And then she had her moment and then it kind of passed and now it's being, it looks like it's going down a very different direction.
That is a very different, Gerwig with her little, I don't know, her twee. If you will. I don't say that pejoratively. I just mean that's kind of her style, I guess. I don't know.
Sure.
Post-mumblecore,
kind of thing.
Well, and then Noah Baumbach, he's kind of, you know, he's got that dry, acerbic kind of weird, naughty humor. So
yeah, and usually kind of darker. Yeah.
And Margot Robbie, she would make a good Barbie, and I could see it being interesting. It's an interesting concoction they're making. I don't know if it's going to be good. I don't know how stifling that the studio is going to be. So all of those things are a factor.
Right. I mean, I think, so there's different ways you can approach this. And it seems like both with the Amy Schumer direction and this direction, it seems clear that the directive is to sort of satirize.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were doing like a straight, like, you know, four quadrant version of this movie, you would probably want to bring in like a Nancy Myers or somebody like that, just somebody like edgeless and boring. But if you're bringing in somebody who has a specific writerly voice like Gerwig and Baumbach, and then even somebody like Margot Robbie, who, yeah, she's, you know, this buxom, beautiful blonde, but she's also kind of a risk taker in the roles she takes. I mean, mm-hmm. She's going to be playing Sharon Tate here soon in a movie about the Manson murders. So I kind of like, I'm excited to see what this is. I think it could be cool.
I mean, I'm always hopeful, and I hope it has a good, like, it has an interesting format. I just don't know. I don't think that they would bring somebody in like those two if they wanted to make a, they've already made 5,000 of those little direct to DVD Barbie movies. So
right.
I don't know why they'd bring them in otherwise. So, but you never know. The studio system is interesting.
It is. Like, sometimes they just see names and they're like, well, people, she was up for an Oscar, so we should give her this huge project. And then they read the script and they go, oh, no, we don't want this. Like, what are you doing?
These are names we've seen in Variety 2 times. We should probably do it. Yeah. No.
Right. Exactly. Okay. I think we'll call that their movie news segment.
We should get the one, just one little one. Taika Waititi back for Thor 4. Come on. That's obvious.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I thought it was irrelevant. Yeah, so Taika Waititi's coming back to do another Thor movie. Of course he is.
But what I think is good about that is that they have, because, you know, something like Guardians of the Galaxy and something like Thor, they actually had kind of a voice to them, and they had kind of a flavor. And so for me, that's a good direction. It's like, yes, bring in more people like that.
So. No, yeah. I mean, I think there's a reason why it used to be that with all of these Marvel movies, they kind of like just shuffled through directors. I mean, there was a, you know, Favreau got a couple Iron Man movies and whatever. And the Russo brothers have been pretty much owning Marvel now. But it seems like the studio is getting a lot more kind of comfortable like handing over entire properties to certain directors to maintain their voice.
When you make a billion almost every single movie, I think they're just like, maybe we should just let them do what they're going to do. So it makes sense. But for as a fan, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it, obviously. I think this next phase in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going to be really interesting because the team doesn't really exist anymore. Like, you know, the Avengers as it was has been pretty well shaken up. And I don't know if they really had a plan for what to do after this point. I'm sure they did. I'm sure these movies are like mapped out like 6 years in advance.
Well,
but
we're going to talk about Spider-Man later.
We are. We can hold some of this discussion.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, wahoo, Taika Waititi's awesome. So it kind of wouldn't have mattered what the movie was. I would have got excited.
Absolutely. All right, cool. Well, let's go ahead and jump into Midsommar because I can't wait to talk about this movie. Okay. You know me, I avoid reviews, I avoid other podcasts to talk about, I avoid whatever until I've had both my written review and the podcast review, so I'm not like accidentally stealing other people's verbiage, and it's been driving me insane because I need to know. But Richard, why don't you go ahead and describe to me what happens in Midsommar? Brief synopsis.
Brief. Death and tragedy. Okay. Basically, a grieving young woman goes on a broad trip with her kind of lousy boyfriend and his friends. They do some drugs. They do some pagan rituals, and they have a good old time. And so this kind of falls in that whole folk horror, whatever realm. If you've seen Wicker Man or some of the other iterations in this kind of like realm, then you kind of know what you're getting in for.
Children of the Corn, kind of.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. The more recent Apostle, if you've seen that on Netflix, kind of a cool film.
The Ritual, kind of in this realm.
Sure. Yeah, but it's its own thing. So this Ari Aster that came in swinging hard with Heredity, he's directing it. It's visually lovely.
It's his follow-up.
It is his follow-up to that. So
and a pretty fast one, too. I mean, Hereditary only came out last year.
Well, I guess he already had this kind of in the kind of in the works. Can.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I know some of the actors who signed up to be in this movie had not even seen Hereditary yet because it wasn't out yet.
Right. That's interesting. Well, no, but he's part of that A24, so I can see like younger actors kind of being like, well, they have a good solid ground. Right. And so this could be interesting. It's an interesting film because while I would still say that it technically falls into like the horror category, it didn't feel like that by the end, even though it was horrific. I agree with some of the kind of the sentiment that's been going around. This is a film about catharsis and that this is a cathartic movie. And that's what I really felt going through it. And even though if you take it at base level, some bad stuff went down. To me, it's more about the feeling and less about the actual, like what's literally happening. So what was some of your takes on this? Sorry, weird volley, but I don't know how much to get into.
No. Yeah, there's, you know, we can kind of dance around some of this stuff. I will say for most people who are listening, if you haven't watched it yet, this is one of those movies with the less you know, the better it is, I think. Absolutely. And I specifically avoided trailers because I kind of knew what it was about. Like, there were some, like, shorter online teasers, and I was like, oh, cool, Ari Aster has a new film. I'm going to see it. Because Hereditary was one of my favorite movies last year. And but this is a very different kind of horror film. Even though it's very clearly the same director, mm-hmm. and he has certain kind of writerly and direct visual sort of obsessions that he follows. There's a lot of kind of Kubrickian style, kind of slow camera subjective stuff, or, you know, like that kind of symmetry in the frame and that kind of stuff. You do see a lot of that mirrors what some of the things that Hereditary was doing. And of course, he kind of hits on a few different things. Both movies deal a lot in like pagan ritual and these kind of weird niches in occultism. And both movies deal a lot with personal tragedy and sort of the metaphor of grief kind of hangs over the entire thing.
At it a very, just to hit on that point before we go past it, the grief kind of theme really, it's really highlighted in different ways by those two films, though. One is kind of about the
stress,
overall stress and just breakdown. Yeah. And then this film is more about kind of getting through it.
In a weird way, it is almost kind of about overcoming grief.
And in both,
where it has almost sort of a positive connotation, whereas the other movie was about grief overtaking a family.
Right. And I would also say another thing that is a hallmark of his film so far is mental health.
Yes.
And how that affects families and how that affects individuals. So I find that's actually been my favorite, kind of some of my favorite themes in both films was the mental health aspects. But
mm-hmm. And I think he does a really, really good job at putting you in the protagonist's minds. Even as, like, he's pulling the screws and he starts to play the genre games and it starts to, you know, it goes into those places. I mean, this movie meets a gore quota, I would say.
It puts it out there, right, in the middle of the screen.
And one of the things I think he's so good at doing and why I think he's such a powerful director is he kind of lulls you into the sense of security with the way he shoots his scenes and how kind of slow pace they are, or not necessarily slow, but just very, very either shifting from traditional coverage to kind of this more pastoral, you know, vistas and that kind of stuff. And he sort of lets you soak in the beauty of the frame. And then he'll just punch you in the face with something you were not prepared to see.
That is true. Now that I'm thinking about it, there is that in Hereditary as well.
Yes.
In this film too, just the setting itself is
very strange.
Everything is in bright, well, not everything, but most everything is in bright ass daylight.
One of the conceits of the movie is that this village that they're visiting in Sweden is during a point of the year where there's only like 2 hours of night. Well, so it's like opposite of 30 days of night.
And what's interesting too is the most, like one of the most genre parts when a certain character is being naughty and looking at some books he's not supposed to.
Sure.
There is a very genre moment at that point, a very horror genre moment at that point.
Oh, there is a direct visual reference to
One of my favorite films.
To Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Right.
And I noticed it immediately.
And it was interesting because that was one of the very few scenes that was done in the dark. Whereas the rest of these were almost in like idyllic, you know?
Like yeah, situations. The rest of the movie, very beautiful, beautiful. It's this weird kind of juxtaposition between like flowers and these lawns and trees and this very earthy kind of thing. Everyone's, you know, dressed in white with these, floral headwear and all this stuff. And then doing just the most bizarre and disgusting things.
And they are alluding to Midsommar, which is
a real thing.
Well, it's a real holiday. Like they actually go out and just kind of chill in nature. And you can look in like, you can look that like downtown, like in downtown in some of the biggest cities in Sweden. And all of these people just drive out into the country for a day and just have this outside day. And so, I mean, I don't know if it goes as far as these rituals. I really doubt it.
I would say for the most part, no.
Peaceful. They just get it all out in one day. It's like their version of a purge. No, I'm kidding. It's very peaceful the way they do it, and it's just kind of a like late, like a actual Labor Day, like an actual day off.
It's probably no weirder than I don't know.
Pioneer
Mardi Gras looks like to a European person.
I was going to say Pioneer Day here in Utah. There's a random holiday of the 24th where
there people is just that.
Go to parks and chill. And to me, it was very weird watching this movie and being like, is there some like weird stuff going on here? Anyway, go for it.
it's interesting we bring up Texas Chainsaw Massacre because that is another horror movie that's largely in the daytime. There's a decent amount that takes place at night, especially some of the horror moments, but that's a movie that also sort of flipped that genre thing.
It flipped the genre thing, and also their daylight. There's a difference because this is like idyllic daytime.
Right.
Like there are some idyllic daytime in Texas Chainsaw Massacre when they're like going to the house and they're on their little vacation and stuff like that. But
yeah.
But the difference is when you get to the daylight for the horror stuff, it's oppressive heat. And it's baking heat. And it's
right. And this looks like a would be, you know, sans all the murder, would be a fun vacation.
Utopia, yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I would still probably live in the neighborhood.
Post-horror. What was I going to say? I was going to say, I think that there's a lot of cool things that are happening in this movie that I think set it apart from its influences. I have seen some people complain that they think it's too similar to The Wicker Man or that it's just a ripoff. I don't think that's the case. I think you're talking about working within a genre. That's, to me, saying this is a ripoff of The Wicker Man is like saying any slasher is just a ripoff of Halloween. I think what's less important than the goings on, and you alluded to this at the beginning of your review. What's less important than what's actually happening is sort of what's happening metaphorically, specifically for this lead character played by Florence Pugh, who I think's terrific, by the way. Mm-hmm. Really, really good, a good performance. And you have this weird thing where you have the almost a largely European cast playing Americans traveling to Europe. Because I think the only actor who's actually American is the black guy,
William Jackson Harper.
Yeah,
he's in a what is that show? He's in a little show I love, The Good Place. There we go. He's right. And he's really funny in that. And so to see him kind of go more dramatic. And kind of more, I really enjoyed his character in this, and not just because of the weird like linkage between those two things, but like he plays like every character, even if they're side characters, has a part to play. It's almost strangely, almost like Shakespearean in that sense. Like,
yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I really like this director is because yes, he's interested in exploring genre. And he's interested in kind of going for it when it comes to the horror stuff. But he also really, really, really likes actors. And you can tell that he gives them a lot of room and he gives them a lot of encouragement to go to very serious places in their performances, which a lot of horror directors just wouldn't bother. They would say, yeah, just scream. That's good.
Well, it depends on what you're coming for. And I think that there's a big crowd of kind of art house horror people now. But the thing that I guess people kind of always, with their traditional, like you're a sadist because you like horror kind of ideals, they're starting to look that even like the gore kids, they like some of this more arty kind of weirder stuff. And they might not like everything. And they might prefer boobies and knives going into people or whatever. But they'll go and see these things and actually kind of talk about them. And I think, but I also just think that there's a straight up crowd for this stuff right now. And it's kind of, it's basically just like a counter movie. So with all these big blockbusters, having these small, intimate, arty horror movies is almost the opposite. And kind of, I think, is a good thing for both horror as a genre, because you've seen them come from all sorts of different sides too. I mean, it's not just like you have like one type, and you do have things that like something like Your Next or something that appeals more to like traditional horror fans. But this, I think, you know, this, I mean, if you're talking in the sense that some people go to a village and there's a death at the end, then I guess that's kind of Wicker Man-esque. But this is a film that's not necessarily about the story arc, even though it has a very traditional story arc. It's about what's happening underneath. And it's playing in theme and it's playing in visuals and it's playing in a bigger playground. And that's something that you can do with genre. And I think that that was smart of him to look at. I think that a lot of people are going to prefer Hereditary over this film, just because I actually think this film is more experimental and a little weirder, even though it's a little more positive.
I liken this a little bit to the Get Out versus Us kind of thing, where I personally thought that Us was a little bit more ambitious and maybe doesn't pay off all the way. But I sort of appreciate the ambition and sort of the artsy weirdness of Us a little bit more than the more straightforward sci-fi horror camp of Get Out. Whereas this movie is kind of the same way, where it's building upon themes of Hereditary, but I think that it it's doing a little bit more risky stuff. Tone-wise, because for one, and we haven't brought this up yet, this movie is also really funny and intentionally so. There's some black humor stuff in Hereditary too, but this movie like goes for these big laughs in these moments where you're at your most tense. And the fact that, you know, that he like goes for that in a movie like this, that's, you know, working on all these different levels of, you know, grief and mental health and you know, Ari Aster calls it a breakup movie. You know, that's working on all those levels and is also not afraid to like totally make these big visual gags is really weird and funny. And I really appreciate that about it.
Well, even some of the worst, like, gore scenes in it almost have kind of a punchline to them. You know, and it has weird, and it is kind of weird if you think about the whole how comedy and horror are kind of kissing cousins. Because of the timing. They're both
built on timing.
And well, not just timing, it's also, like, most of them have punchlines, you know? Horror is just the opposite kind of punchline. You're not going for laugh. But this is kind of doing both at the same time sometimes. And it is a weird film, but I guess something that I gauged in one of my kind of reference points is, you know, Jackie's not, she's not a navel gazer like you and I. And she just kind of watches it and lets it wash over her and then just kind of makes a gut feeling about it. She doesn't pick it apart and gnaw on it. And I asked her after and she's like, no, I like it. And to me, that's kind of almost telling because she's, as a horror fan, she'll tell you straight up if she didn't like something. And she knows. And so for me, this was an interesting because it is very artsy, very weird, but it also, I think, has some kind of strange, nice appeal. It's a weird, it's a strange movie. It really is. But I wouldn't thought of that if I didn't come and talk to you and like have to actually like analyze it. Because just as a film, I was like, oh, that was light and weird and kind of made me feel good. Why was that? And it's that weird cathartic kind of nature, and it could be the breakup narrative, or it could be the grieving narrative, and I think either way, it's kind of about just how we go through things.
Mm-hmm, I watched an interview with Ari Aster where, and it might have been before he even did Midsommar. It might have been an interview from when he was still doing press for Hereditary, but he was talking about his big influences as a director. Or movies he saw that he was kind of like considering. And one that he brought up, and I would not have thought of this had he not brought it up, but it totally makes sense to me, is Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Okay.
Which is another film that is, it was rated NC-17 at the time, which was like 1990, 1989, something like that. Helen Mirren and all of that. And it's this movie that it was when the Greenaway went to the MPAA and said, okay, well, what do I have to cut to get it down to an R? And they just said, there's nothing, because there's nothing we can tell you to cut because it's not any one thing. It's like the film itself is just so beyond disturbed. We can't find what's going to make it better.
The tone of that is a weird tone, too. So that's interesting.
Right, because that's not exactly a horror film, but there are some really fucked up things in that movie.
It is. It's a weird, dark comedy.
And also kind of funny.
It's not a horror comedy by any means either, though. And not even a thriller. Right. It's just a very dark, strange movie that's kind of funny sometimes and kind of not.
But it's also very, very visually concerned, and he does these long pans and stuff like that. So I can see the influencer.
Well, and I will say there's one thing, a weird little thing. Ari Aster kept saying, like, before, because I'd see little blips on the internet where you're not allowed to not see things. And he kept saying that this was going to be like the Wizard of Oz for perverts. And I didn't get that from the film at all. So, Ari, I don't know what the hell's going on in your brain, buddy, but that was not a thing.
I kind of get
that. I'm a pervert, and it didn't do it for me.
So I kind of get what he's saying. I think because the idea of, like, you know, this group of people going to this magical place and then it just going south. So, in that sense, I get the connection. And then also sort of, you know, the poppy fields and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And this movie has, like, this, you know, specifically because there's a lot of, like, drugs being done in the movie, there's sort of the psychedelic element to the movie.
Oh, very much. There's a third act piece that is very psychedelic.
Right.
In a lovely way.
Yeah, and that's done in a really cool way, and especially from perspective and that kind of stuff. And I think that there is a connection between that and sort of the fantasia of Wizard of Oz, where it's all in, you know, supposedly in somebody's head.
I see what you're both saying, and if you just said it was, you know, it has some Wizard of Oz elements, I would agree.
Yeah.
But he said it was the Wizard of Oz for perverts.
And well,
for
I mean,
me, that would be, you know, that it didn't go far enough for that. If he wants that, if he wants that belt, he has to go for it, and it just didn't earn that. Sorry.
He's still in contention with David Lynch's Wild at Heart, as far as that goes.
Well, and I would say, you know, if something's still going to beat, if just off the top of my head, a movie that would beat that would be Eyes Wide Shut.
Okay, sure. I'd say sort of in the same realm. But yeah, I greatly enjoyed this movie. I'm going to say probably my favorite movie of the year so far. It's the one to beat. for the rest of the year for me, because this hit a lot of stuff that I like going to the movies to see. And I did see it twice, which I haven't done with any other movie yet.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. I haven't seen that many films, so that's going to be a small list to compare it to. But I really enjoyed it. And as far as having an adult time out with my wife and away from our kid and having to think about something and talk about it, it was nice. And again, like I said, I left the film in a good mood. like in a really good mood. And that's a weird thing for a horror movie of this type. So I enjoyed it for that fact. I enjoy it for the strangeness of it in a good way. So,
yeah. Okay, cool. Let's go ahead and move on now to Spider-Man Far From Home. And I guess I'll set this up a little bit. This is the sequel, Marvel's sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming that came out, what, 2 years ago?
Something like that.
Yeah. And this picks up where the last one left off. Well, specifically, this picks up where Avengers Endgame left off. So if you've seen that, you know that half the world's population disappeared. And then through the goings on of Avengers Endgame, they come back 5 years later. So the Earth is trying to kind of catch up to this, and everyone's sort of trying to find their footing again. Tony Stark is no longer. So everyone's sort of having this identity crisis as far as what is the Marvel Cinematic Universe now. And this movie's sort of trying to bridge that gap to a certain extent. So
interesting term you use, identity crisis.
Such a nerd. Okay, so well, Tom Holland.
But in a lot of ways, this movie is about identity crisis. I was being a nerd.
Oh, I thought you make a comic reference.
Both. I'm a little bit.
Tom Holland returns as plays Peter Parker. He's going to Europe for a field trip, and he's going to take a break from being Spider-Man, a concerted effort to not be Spider-Man, to just chill with his friends, go see some sights in Europe. But of course, he kind of gets roped into some superhero chicanery because, Nick Fury ropes him back into a caper in which, we meet Jake Gyllenhaal as Mysterio from another universe, a different universe version of Mysterio, who comes and he's trying to take out these elementals that have somehow appeared and causing destruction all around the sites where Spider-Man just happens to be, or where Nick Fury happens to keep moving his class so that Spider-Man can be near enough to save the day. So then he kind of gets caught into this, like, sort of hijinks of he wants to try and get closer to MJ so he can confess his undying love, but he also needs to go and be a superhero sometime. So it's this kind of back and forth, like the end of Mrs. Doubtfire when he's like at the restaurant and he's like, you know, has one family he has to be Robin Williams and the other family he has to be Doubtfire. Kind of a lot of those type of situations going on. And we find out a little bit more about Mysterio and a little bit more about Tony Stark's technology that's been left to Peter as a gift.
I liked it. I think it's a little tighter than the first film. The MCU stuff didn't feel as just like so MCU-y. Like I didn't feel like I was like, I don't know. Like the first in Homecoming, I really wasn't a huge fan of the Tony Stark stuff. It did set up a good arc between the two, but it felt really tacked on, and I just really wanted to see him in high school. Whereas, I for whatever reason, Nick Fury is just one of those ancillary characters that can pop up anywhere, and he just makes sense. And so I kind of felt that way about it with him. I really, really like Jake Gyllenhaal as Mysterio.
Yeah.
Probably one of the best things about this film.
I would agree.
And I'm just going to go out there. If you have this, first of all, this is like a huge budget. It's made a huge amount of money.
Right.
If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen it, I'm going to spoil stuff. And this is your fault for not going and see it. You've had plenty of time. Get up off your lazy ass and go watch it. Unless you don't want to. Then you're going to get my spoilers.
Spoiler warning.
Come on. Who didn't know that Mysterio was going to be a bad guy?
Right.
I'm fine with them trying to sell me that he was going to be a good guy, but when the moment happens, which is a great moment, I found it rather lovely anyways.
To me, that saved the movie. Oh, I mean, I was enjoying it up to that point in like the most basic sort of way, like, this is Spider-Man, that's cool, whatever. And then that moment happens and you see that turn and Gyllenhaal, because up to that point, I was like, they're kind of wasting Jake Gyllenhaal. Like, he's this very risk-taking weirdo actor at this point. And here he is, just a guy in a cape flying around, like, kind of seemed like he was phoning it in. And then you see what's really going on. And I was like, oh, okay. No, you're perfect.
Well, and absolutely, yes. You're right about, we're in agreement upon that. And he, as a weirdo actor, he just, it sells the part so well, because it gets really weirder on the back end. Talking about a movie full of CG, but a character who is basically using CG as a weapon, which is a really interesting thing for a big blockbuster film to do. The drones, all that was very interesting, almost at a science fiction level. Not quite a science fiction level, but interesting at that level.
I think it was kind of necessary. Like, I will say there's still too much, like, even though Tony Stark's not in this movie, the ghost of Tony Stark is definitely in this movie. And I'm still not in love with this interpretation of Spider-Man as just being an Avengers stan.
Well,
but
it depends on what your Spider-Man very much is, like, kind of like the typical, like, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, 1960s to 1970s. I've read from basically almost day one of the Ultimate Universe of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Including the Miles Morales stuff. So a lot of this stuff to me feels familiar in that sense.
Okay, that's fine. But what I was going to say about the drone stuff is I think it makes sense to include that in Mysterio's repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go back to the original comics or the cartoon or whatever, the Mysterio was originally a special effects dude who got mad because he was fired or something, and uses these little, like, VFX boxes to create these holograms or whatever.
Which actually makes it make more sense to be drones, because before I was always like, what does that mean, hologram box?
Right. But. So, there's not that much you can really do with that. I mean, you can, like, trick somebody for a minute. And they do some fun things in the movie about, like, Peter having to trust his spider sense rather than what he's seeing, and like playing with that in a way.
Playing with his Peter tingle.
Right. I think that the inclusion of drone technology in that, like, makes that a bit more of a real threat and also a little bit more believable. Absolutely. Am I giving away too much to say that, like, Mysterio was written to be a ex-Stark Industries employee?
I don't think so. Again, we said spoiler alert. If you're listening, this is your bad.
Because I actually like that interpretation more than an ex-VFX guy. I think that it makes sense, A, for this version of Spider-Man that they've written. And also, it pulls in these characters who were just in, like, one shot in the background of other movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, gives them something to do. And so there's kind of a funny thing there that I appreciated.
Oh, I see all of that stuff where he's, like, complaining about, like, Steve drag his suit and all that stuff. I was way into.
Yeah. Yeah, no, me too.
No, the combining and kind of the anger behind it. No, I think what's interesting about both films is the underlying factor is, and I don't mind this part of Tony Stark's ghost in both Homecoming and this film, is that he's kind of a tertiary villain in both Homecoming and this film, because the Vulture wouldn't have been doing what he did without, you know, the Tony Stark Industries.
Right.
And Tony's big thing the whole time was about what, like, monsters he's created. And so in that way, I think is actually kind of a cool kind of way to keep playing in those thematics.
Right.
And also, people have been talking about it, but I think it is true, is that this film, you know, in our day of fake news and alternate storylines and all everything you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What is the fact versus the fiction? This film plays in that world in an interesting and fun way. I think that this film is better than the other one. It still feels strange because we are post Endgame and that was so huge.
Right.
But it was almost kind of refreshing to kind of reset it at a more human level.
No, I think that's true, and I think that was strategic on Marvel's part. I also think that this movie feels smaller than even Homecoming, because I think Homecoming had kind of a lot to establish mm-hmm. because they're reintroducing this character. They're trying to connect him to this universe. They kind of wanted to make a splash with it, whereas this movie feels a little bit more comfortable in its own skin.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's things I like about this movie a lot, and then there's things that kind of annoy me. And it mostly has to do with just sort of the reinterpretation of the character. There's things about it where, like there's a scene in the movie where...
Not your Spider-Man.
There's a scene in the movie where Spider-Man is having his big confrontation with... Or one of the big confrontations with Mysterio, and Mysterio's talking to him overhead, a speaker of some sort, and he starts to see all these crazy things, and it's like, you know, that's one of the points where he has to, like, trust his spider sense. So it's like, yes, this is Spider-Man. This is recognizably Spider-Man. But there's a lot of times where I'm like, Ned and stuff, and, like, him walking around, and, like, Happy is there, like, doing stuff, and... And then, you know, he's wearing, like, the black night monkey suit, which I thought was funny. It was a good whatever. But I was like, is this Spider-Man? I mean, their reinterpretation of Mary Jane is, like, wildly different.
Little Mermaid. No!
It's not a black Little Mermaid situation. It has more to do with her personality. Yeah, because in this movie, she's, like... She's not Molly Ringwald from The Breakfast Club. She's Ally Sheedy from The Breakfast Club. And so there's a lot of times where I'm like, you know, this is cool, I guess, but is this Spider-Man really other than in name only? And the fact that he has webs?
No, I agree in the sense with the getting the... I would say Happy, the Tony Stark elements, and the, like, technological... What I mean by that is the technological suit.
Right.
But it is kind of, if you go from every era besides the classic era of Spider-Man, even in the classic Spider-Man era, he had these weird little friend groups. And that's where...
Yeah.
Specifically, Ned is kind of a mix between two characters. He's a mix between a character that in the future becomes a villain. So kind of spoiler alert, maybe, possibly, but not. But who becomes Hobgoblin. That was one of those, like, side friends of Peter Parker at one time, because he was in the college years and he had all these different friends and stuff like that. I think he was dating Gwen Stacy at the time. And then you've got, like, Genki, which comes from the Miles Morales Spider-Man, which people are familiar with and I can just talk about normally because of the Spider-Verse movie. Thank God for that movie. That's still the best Spider-Man film, and that's going to be the benchmark for a while.
And maybe this movie suffers a little bit in that it came out after that, because I think that movie was so definitively Spider-Man. Even though that movie is, like, much wilder in a lot of ways, and asks
it's much wilder than a lot of films,
right? And it asks you to sort of accept a lot. This movie is comparatively asking you to accept much less. But as a Spider-Man fan, I find myself kind of like, this is some generation Spider-Man, but it's not necessarily mine.
Yeah, not my Spider-Man. Sorry, I'll stop. I've just
made Spider-Man just great again.
Going back to the themes of the film. No, I see what you're saying, and there was something. I think you did say something that for me is at least correct, is the fact that Spider-Verse kind of still has done it better. And so while I really enjoyed this film, and I have very few critiques, because I really didn't like those Tony Stark kind of add-on moments from the first Homecoming. I didn't like them. They felt tacked on. The Nick Fury ones, they go into the film. They feel a part of. So I think John Watts and Marvel Studios have done very, very well in this interpretation. But yeah, my Spider-Man is kind of that schlubby Peter Parker from Spider-Verse.
And maybe, you know, like, maybe there's just, like, certain key things that are just not there yet that once they are, I will feel more comfortable, like him being a photographer, things like that. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to go that direction. By the looks at the end of the movie, they're probably not.
It's not traditional in the sense that it's not been built from the ground up, which was good.
Right.
But at the same time, we're kind of playing catch up in some weird ways. And
right.
I haven't for a long time saw a love relationship. I thought the Mary Jane stuff was cute.
I didn't have a problem with it in my heart.
But
I don't have a problem with this interpretation of the Mary Jane Spider-Man romance. And I think that it's not what they're doing, you know, it's, or even how they're doing it. It's just, sometimes to me, it's so different that I'm like, this is even more of a departure than Ultimate Spider-Man in a lot of ways. There's a little bit of me just kind of like getting used to it, but I think functionally the movie works just fine.
It is the MCU Spider-Man for sure. I see what you're saying, and I do get your point. It feels almost like it is its own entity, whereas a lot of the other like characters have been a little bit more grounded in the classic kind of Iron Man, Captain America, whatever subject.
Right.
Even though they've pulled from Ultimates a lot throughout the whole MCU.
Right.
But this one does have its own kind of flavor, and maybe that's because there's already been so many interpretations and they're so close to it. Maybe they just feel like they have to make it enjoyable and not just feel like humdrum. And bringing in, not the same old villains again is interesting.
Yeah.
As for the kind of stingers, I do think that the J. Jonah Jameson one, we've already talked spoilers, so if you are coming in, this is your fault. Your fault. The J. Jonah Jameson one, is that one kind of freaked me out. We'll see where it goes, but it could be interesting in a good way or interesting in a bad way. So,
right.
But I do like, but generally how that all happened, I enjoyed. And I do enjoy that the swinging, that Mary Jane's swinging with Peter Parker, she's not like, oh, this is so much fun. And it's so like, I liked that she was like, this is awful.
Yeah. Let's never do that again.
Yeah. Because it would be scary as shit.
Yeah.
From a normal human perspective, going like 100 swinging on ropes down the middle of New York is not a fun time.
No.
Can I make some future predictions?
Sure.
Theorizing.
Go for it.
Okay, so the Joe Jenny Jameson thing, besides people have pointed out kind of he has kind of an Alex Jonesy kind of feel to
Info him. InfoWars kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. So they could go the whole, they've already introduced the Mac Gargan character in the first film, so they might go the whole Scorpion, Spider Slayer, all that kind of stuff for the next film. That's a guess. Second theory, and this is one that I haven't seen put out there a lot. I've seen one article about it, and they didn't go into depth. Okay, so when I first saw the four elementals in the film, first thing that comes to mind is the Fantastic Four.
Why?
Because their powers originally were elemental, and that they stand for air, water, fire, and rock, and earth.
Okay.
And so with these four characters and them selling that, I was like, well, if they are selling that this Mysterio is from some other Earth, and then they're bringing up, maybe they're trying to bring in the Fantastic Four.
Right, but they established... No.
Just wait. You're... Okay. Now, we established that Quentin Beck is full of baloney and that he is not from another galaxy. Yes, I get that. But who buys it hook, line, and sinker when they're talking about it? The elementals, and some cultures worship them as gods. Nick Fury. What do we know about Nick Fury in this film?
He's a Skrull.
Exactly. Skrulls are a big part of Fantastic Four. And so if they actually do have these kind of like gods, I think that that's them alluding to them coming up. I really do.
Wow. Okay. So in Richard's apartment right now, you can see like a big map behind him with a bunch of red string being tied. If you've
seen the Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny, yes.
You know the meme. Yeah.
You know the meme. That's just me in general life. But I think this is for legit because I don't think actual Nick Fury would be like, what is this bullshit? What are you talking about? Four elements. I think that is part of it. And I think that they are bringing it in. And it didn't make sense. And at first I was like, oh, well, that's weird that they're going to kind of set that stuff up with the four elements and cosmic powers and all that kind of stuff and then not go there. But then when the stinger then it finally tied together when it was like, oh, they're Skrulls.
Mm.
So no, there's a hint there. You let it work out in your brain, Cassidy. You'll see.
All right. No, you make a convincing argument. You could definitely write a Reddit post about this and get some traction on it. All right. I think we're going to end it there. Thanks for being on the podcast. Thanks for stepping in for Keith while he's Comic-Conning.
Yeah, no problem.
And I'm sure when he comes back, he'll have all the things to say about what he did at Comic-Con. Richard, before I say a bunch of things, where can people find your media presence?
R.D. Wally, spelled W-O-L-L-E-Y, /Weebly.com. You can find me. Probably the easier way is just Google. I have two short stories in two different things. You can find links to both of those. One's about a Cthulian blob that makes friends with a boy, and they have hijinks. And then another short story is about it's a coming of age horror story. So that's where you can find me and what you can find from me.
All right, cool. And if you have anything to say about anything we've talked about in this podcast or previous podcast episodes, you can email us at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. You can also find the stuff that I've written for the Idaho State Journal at their website, idahostatejournal.com/movies or entertainment or something like that. You can find the tabs, click on them, and you should be able to see some of my reviews. Follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can follow the show at MacGuffinPod. You can also follow us on Instagram at MacGuffinPod and on Facebook at Facebook.com/MacGuffinPod. Also, be sure to check out the content that's being written by the MacGuffin staff over at their website, MacGuff.in, where you can also find the RSS feed for this podcast. Keith, he has stuff. I think it's keithfosterkid.com. If you want to check out his comedy dates or whatever over in San Diego, that's where they are. I think we're going to call that the episode.
Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
Bye.
Bye.